This is The Takeaway, coming to you from WKSU in Kent, Ohio, from the campus of Kent State University. But today we start the show in California.
The backstop for an execution for taking of another life is the governor of the state of California. And with respect to everyone here, when I was standing on this side and I wasn't standing here, it was an intellectual conversation. It's a very emotional place that I stand in.
One quarter of the people facing the death penalty in the United States are in California. On Wednesday, Governor Gavin Newsom issued a moratorium on executions in the state, granting at least a temporary reprieve for the 737 inmates on death row in California.
I am expressing this not from paradigm of politics. It's not a situational conversation for me. This is about who I am as a human being. This is about what I can or cannot do. To me, this is the right thing to do.
This decision puts California alongside a growing number of states that are moving away from capital punishment. 10 states over the past 10 years. And death penalty opponents remain adamant that it's a flawed system and morally wrong. So let's start there. Here with me now is Marisa Lagos, a political correspondent for KQED in San Francisco. Hi, Marisa.
Hey, Tanzina.
And I'm also joined by Carol Steiker, a professor at Harvard Law School and co-author of Courting Death, the Supreme Court, and Capital Punishment. Carol, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks, Tanzina.
So, Marisa, let's start with you. Tell us what this moratorium means for inmates on California's death row right now.
Well, in practice, it means that we will not be seeing any executions soon, although I should note we haven't had any in California since 2006. But what really prompted this was Newsom's basically being advised by his legal team that as soon as next month, the state corrections department would be asking him to sign off on the protocols for executing people. And so he basically issued this executive order saying, as long as I'm governor, we are not going to execute anybody. He also announced the closing of the death chamber at San Quentin Prison, just north of San Francisco, and the withdrawal of those regulations that basically set out how you actually would put somebody to death in California. So it's not a commutation of these sentences. The next governor could reverse it, but it also means that the courts don't have the ability to review this because it's a reprieve, not a commutation, which has sort of different legal implications.
Carol, what can you tell us about how Governor Newsom's decision squares with the state of the death penalty across the country? We mentioned in the opening here that there have been 10 states in 10 years who have changed their stance on the death penalty.
Yes, I think it's true that Governor Newsom's action is very much in line with what we're seeing nationally on the death penalty. You know, back in the early 1970s, the U.S. Supreme Court abolished the death penalty in the United States in a landmark decision in 1972 called Furman versus Georgia, brought it back 4 years later in 76. And from 76 to now, we've really been on a roller coaster. From 76 until around 2000, the death penalty was really soaring everywhere, including in California. But from 2000 to now, basically the last two decades, it's been in free fall. And the death penalty, just to give a sense of what I mean, the peak of death sentencing was in 1996 nationwide when 315 people were added to death row in a single year. The recent low, 2016, 31 people were added to death row. So that's a decline of more than 90% from the peak in the 90s till now. We see the same thing with executions. We see state legislative abolition and judicial abolition. The death penalty is really withering on the vine.
Carol, why is that? What is there some sort of moral or social or economic argument that's sort of connecting all of these, this decline?
Yeah, I think the arguments are very much, the reasons are very much those that the governor stated. One thing that I think precipitated this decline is the advent of DNA testing and the recognition that there have been wrongful death sentences. So people have been exonerated off of death row around the country, and that's a rather terrifying prospect. And that really, I think, gave a big bump to public opinion with regard to the death penalty. Similarly, you know, from 1976 till now, when the Supreme Court brought back the death penalty, it didn't just bring it back and say, hey, do whatever you want now. The Supreme Court has really regulated the death penalty through the Constitution, requiring all kinds of new statutes, new procedures, new kinds of death penalty trials and review of those cases that have been extraordinarily expensive, so that now the cost of the death penalty vastly exceeds the cost of sentencing someone to life imprisonment.
Marisa, you spoke to Governor Newsom yesterday, and this announcement sort of reminds, I think, a lot of Californians about his own decision to go against the Democratic Party and legalize gay marriage when he was the mayor of San Francisco in 2004. And you talked to him about the similarities in those two instances yesterday. Let's take a listen.
Similar sentiment, you know, in terms of how we approach this. When I told my staff that I wanted to move forward in this direction, and everybody's reaction and counsel and concern. For me, the other similarity is this. I just think it was the right thing to do.
Marisa, what do we know about Governor Newsom's approach here? What does this tell us about who he is as a politician?
You know, it's interesting. I've been covering him since he was mayor. And the thing that really strikes me these days about him is how open he is about his sort of personal experience and how it's informing this policy. So he talked a lot about a case that both his grandfather and his father worked really hard on over their lifetime to basically get a man who had been accused of being a mob hitman off of out of prison. This guy did not get the death penalty, but missed it by one jury's vote. And Newsom kind of grew up with that case in his, you know, zeitgeist. He talked about visiting death row and seeing a high school classmate on death row who he didn't know had been there. He talked about his own experience with his mom fostering kids and realizing the sort of racial inequities just around the criminal justice system. And so I think that, you know, that's not dissimilar to the things he talks about in 2004 when he was looking at gay marriage and sort of experiencing through other couples that he knew in San Francisco, you know, their heartache at not being able to do that. And so I think that, you know, for him, he basically framed this as something that he thought he was going to have to deal with in this term, but maybe not this soon. And that he just decided he didn't want to kind of nibble around the edges once it became clear that it was going to confront him soon. He wanted to kind of go all in and really tackle the heart of the matter, not just deal with, say, the regulations or other things. I mean, and the other part of what he said about the similarities was he didn't want to do what he thought the Obama administration did, which was, in his mind, under same-sex marriage, carry on the same policy as the Bush administration. You know, he didn't go after his predecessor, Jerry Brown, but he basically made clear that he didn't think that sort of continuing to plot along this path that was going to lead back to executions was fair. And, you know, to the professor's point, I think it's important to note, he basically said, given the statistics about what we know about innocence, among death row inmates around the nation, he believes as many as 30 inmates on death row in California out of that 737 could be innocent. And so he said to him, that was sort of the question of the day. It was really not the question of whether, you know, what a family would weigh when they're looking at this, but what he had to look at as governor, which was, as he put it, lining up, you know, a different person every day for 2 years for execution if you were actually to go through with every single one of those inmates.
We're talking about the moratorium on the death penalty in California and what it means for the country here on The Takeaway. Carol, Florida was the second state after California with the next largest number of death row inmates in the nation, followed by Texas. Do we think this decision is going to have any impact on those states, particularly Texas?
Well, you know, both Florida and Texas have seen similar declines in their use of the death penalty over the past 20 years. So, you know, everywhere around the country, we are seeing this withering. On the other hand, you know, will governors in those states or will the legislatures in those states call a halt to executions? I think not. I think that what this action does is really bring to light and public attention in a greater way the dysfunction of the death penalty, the problem of wrongful convictions, the problem of racial discrimination, the extraordinary high costs for very little return. So I think it is part of that larger conversation. But I think the most interesting way in which Governor Newsom's action may affect the death penalty in places like Texas, Florida, Alabama, places where we're not going to see similar actions, is that the U.S. Supreme Court you know, as I said, back in the 1970s, abolished the death penalty. And in my book, Courting Death, one of the things that I predict, along with my co-author, is that eventually the death penalty will end in the United States in the same way, because I don't think we're going to see legislative action in some of the states that still maintain the death penalty. That's what sets the United States apart from our peer countries that have abolished the death penalty. There's a deep commitment to federalism by which the states get to decide individually unless they run afoul of the Constitution.
Well, and in this case, I want to point out here that, and I want to bring in Marisa one last minute here, because Californians in the state actually voted to uphold the death penalty most recently in 2016, and Newsom went against the will of the voters. And I'm curious, Marisa, you were able to talk to him about that. Let's take a listen to what he had to say.
I've long been strong in my opposition to the death penalty. So if it ends up back on the ballot, I would certainly be active and supportive. But what I hope our action did today is it starts a conversation anew. It begins the debate anew. It puts in perspective the magnitude of California's role as it relates to the death penalty, not just nationally, but internationally.
Marisa, given what we just heard from Carol and also what Gavin Newsom just said, could he face political blowback in California?
I think he will. I think more likely, though, I don't see this as career ending for him in any way. He just got elected, but it's very possible, in fact, likely, that this will be posed to voters in 2020. And I think the question is sort of how much political capital and money will he and other Democrats put behind it, and what position will it put more moderate Democrats in, who took some of those more purple districts in November.
Marisa Lagos is a political reporter for KQED and co-host of the podcast Political Breakdown. Marisa, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
And Carol Steiker is a professor at Harvard Law School and co-author of the book Courting Death, The Supreme Court and Capital Punishment. Carol, thanks to you as well.
Thank you.
For years now, lethal injection has been a major point of contention in Ohio. And this month, executions in the state grinded to a temporary halt. In a January ruling, federal magistrate Judge Michael Merz stopped short of declaring Ohio's lethal injection system unconstitutional, but he did say that the state's use of the drug midazolam in executions would cause, quote, severe pain and needless suffering. And in the months since, Ohio's Republican Governor Mike DeWine has brought four different executions to a halt while the state looks for other lethal injection options. And it could take years before an alternative will be found. And I'm joined now by Andrew Welsh Huggins, associate press editor and reporter focusing on criminal justice and author of No Winners Here Tonight, a book about the history of the death penalty in Ohio. Andrew, thanks for being with us.
Good to be here.
So can you take us back to the last time the death penalty was halted in Ohio, 2014? What happened then?
So in the 2014 execution of Dennis McGuire, the state had been struggling to find lethal injection drugs at that point, and they used a never-tried-before two-drug method. The first drug is a drug called midazolam, which we can talk about in a second, which is at the heart of a lot of what's happening. Midazolam is essentially a sedative. It's like Valium. And the second drug was a painkiller. That was a very problematic execution. It lasted 26 minutes, the longest in Ohio modern history. McGuire's chest heaved, he gasped, he snorted. It's very uncomfortable to look at. Afterwards, there were civil rights lawsuits filed against the state over that. The state more or less immediately put executions on hold while it looked for a new method because it was quite clear that particular true drug method was not going to work going forward.
I just want to be clear. So the state wasn't looking to eliminate the death penalty. It was looking for a way to, or less painful or maybe even a more humane way to carry them out. Is that right?
That's right. And more to the point, something that was constitutional. I think it was pretty clear that given the lawsuits that were coming after the McGuire execution, it was pretty clear that that method was never going to be found constitutional. So they needed to find a new method that would be constitutional that they could go forward with.
And we know that executions resumed in 2017 here in the state. What was the solution that they settled on?
So in October of 2016, they finally came up with a new three-drug method. So Ohio, for many years, like states around the country, had used a three-drug method. The difference with their new system is that they started again with this midazolam, which again is it's a sedative. What states, including Ohio, had used before were barbiturates like pentobarbital and sodium thiopental. Basically, those are the drugs that you put your pets down with. Those drugs can render inmates so deeply unconscious. In fact, a single heavy dose of those drugs will put someone to death. The concern with midazolam is that it never puts inmates so deeply unconscious that then they won't feel the next drug, which is a paralytic, and the final drug, which stops their hearts. And the argument is that no amount of midazolam, you can increase the dose as much as you want, but there's a ceiling effect where it still won't put the inmates under. That's been the problem in Ohio since. Now, they have carried out three executions with that new method, and you know they were certainly nothing like the McGuire method, but they were a little bit uncomfortable to watch, and it's a little unclear. We just don't know what the inmates were feeling. And that drug, midazolam, is the one that Magistrate Judge Merz focused on in his most recent ruling, where he said essentially this could cause inmates to undergo an experience similar to waterboarding.
But that still wasn't declared unconstitutional.
That's right. He said in a very carefully crafted opinion that he was not comfortable with that particular outcome, but there was a second test that an inmate in Ohio would have to meet before he could declare the death penalty or the system unconstitutional, and that is they would have to prove that there were viable alternatives available, that there was something else the state could use. And he said that particular inmate had not proved that, and therefore the execution could proceed.
Andrew, what happens next? How long is it before a lethal injection system can be put into place? And is there any movement in the state to try and eliminate executions altogether?
So to answer your first question, we're looking at months or years. The execution that Governor Mike DeWine postponed as an immediate result of that ruling, that's been postponed till September. There's no way the state will have a new lethal injection system in place by September. Even if they came up with the drugs tomorrow, the lawsuits would launch immediately, and that would go straight into the courts. So we're looking at months or probably years before the state, if ever, comes up with a new lethal injection system. To answer your second question, there is no move in Ohio to eliminate the death penalty. There are certainly some legislative proposals to further restrict who could be executed. But I think what you'll see in Ohio next will be conversations about should we just get rid of lethal injection and look for another alternative. So other states have been doing this. Oklahoma, Alabama, and Mississippi have authorized the use of nitrogen gas, although it hasn't been used. That method has been very preliminarily talked about as something in Ohio. Other states like Mississippi, Oklahoma, Utah now allow the firing squad. And in some states, they've returned to the electric chair. Tennessee executed two inmates last year, very close to one another with the electric chair. And in fact, in Tennessee, inmates are actually suing to allow themselves to be executed by electric chair over lethal injection.
Andrew Welsh Huggins is an Associated Press reporter and editor based in Ohio. Andrew, thank you.
You're very welcome.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. On Friday, students around the world are set to walk out of school in a coordinated effort to send a message about global warming. Many young people aren't only aware of the dangers posed by climate change, they're also fed up with what they see as an inadequate response from the older generation in power.
Jorge Echevarria. I live in the Bronx and I'm in 11th grade. I mean, the way the world is going, soon we're going to have constant hurricanes, tornadoes, stuff like that. So I feel like if we don't put a stop to it, it's going to eventually end the world.
Hi, my name is Eric Flores. I go to Heritage High School. I'm 17 years old. I know it's messing up the environment, and I know it's going to lead to the world's decay faster.
You might remember that back in October, the United Nations released a report predicting that humans have just 12 years to slow global temperature rise and prevent catastrophe. And young people are the ones who are going to have to live through it. The Takeaway spoke with New York City students to hear how they're thinking about climate change.
I'm Mary. I go to school at Our Lady of Pompeii School. And I'm 12. Or 13.
Hi, I'm Maria, and I go to Our Lady of Pompeii School. I'm 13.
I'm kind of worried that there's going to be a lot less land and oxygen, plants and stuff, and how that we could really get severely hurt because of that.
Because it could really affect the Earth and like how our lives could change. And it's all created by us.
Organizers are hoping tomorrow's youth climate strike will be a wake-up call to the leaders in charge, even if many of the protesters are still too young to vote the grown-ups out of office.
If we want to keep the Earth living, if we want to keep the Earth strong, then we have to focus on climate change, and we have to take the measures and the precautions to deal with that.
Hey, it's going to affect you someday, so just be cautious and don't allow yourself to be part of the problem.
But as students across at least 98 countries plan to join the strike, on Tuesday, President Trump tweeted another message questioning the science behind climate change.
Hi, I'm Kayra. I'm 12 years old.
Hi, my name is Sophia. I go to the School Lady of Pompeii, and I'm 12 years old.
Well, the president does really just focus on building the wall, which is honestly not that important because, honestly, we're all people.
I would think that he should take a little bit of focus off of his wall and onto climate change. But, yeah, that's just me.
Instead of building a wall, we should focus on climate change.
I would tell the authority figure that they should really take action and take control over the problems.
Young Americans say they hope that Friday's protests will be a very visible reminder that climate change demands action.
Haven Coleman, I am 12 years old, almost 13. I will be 13 on March 29th.
Haven is one of the founders and co-directors of the U.S. Youth Climate Strike.
I'm really looking for, like, since we have so many locations, like almost all 50 states, I think we're only missing like 3 states, that it'll like be a big turnout so that we can like catch the adults' attention and get adults to actually stop and think and actually act. Climate change is not only just going to affect me and my future, it's going to be affecting everybody and everyone. And every generation after mine.
And she told us why this issue is so important to her.
We've dealt with it. We've grown up with climate change. I always remember hearing about this hurricane, this flood, this drought. Like Colorado, where I live, has been in a 19-year drought. We've grown up on climate change. And so when we hear that we have a chance to stop the worst effects, to stop anything, to do anything, we've taking that opportunity, which is sort of surprising that the adults haven't been taking this opportunity.
Voices from students ahead of tomorrow's global climate walkout. And you can find all of our show's coverage of environmental issues online at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is supported by Indeed. With Indeed, employers can post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on a short list of screen candidates using an online dashboard. More info at Indeed.com.
On Friday, students around the world are set to walk out of school in a coordinated effort to send a message about global warming. Many young people aren't only aware of the dangers posed by climate change, they're also fed up with what they see as an inadequate response from the older generation in power.
Jorge Echevarria, I live in the Bronx and I'm in 11th grade. I mean, the way the world is going, soon we're going to have constant hurricanes, tornadoes, stuff like that. So I feel like if we don't put a stop to it, it's going to eventually end the world.
Hi, my name is Eric Flores. I go to Heritage High School. I'm 17 years old. I know it's messing up the environment, and I know it's going to lead to the world to decay faster.
You might remember that back in October, the United Nations released a report predicting that humans have just 12 years to slow global temperature rise and prevent catastrophe. And young people are the ones who are going to have to live through it. The Takeaway spoke with New York City students to hear how they're thinking about climate change.
I'm Mary. I go to school at Our Lady of Pompeii School. and I'm 12. Or 13, 13, 13.
Hi, I'm Maria, and I go to Our Lady of Pompeii School. I'm 13.
I'm kind of worried that there's going to be a lot less land and oxygen, plants and stuff, and how that we could really get severely hurt because of that. Mm-hmm.
Because it could really affect the Earth and like how our lives could change. And it's all created by us.
Organizers are hoping tomorrow's youth climate strike will be a wake-up call to the leaders in charge, even if many of the protesters are still too young to vote the grown-ups out of office.
If we want to keep the Earth living, if we want to keep the Earth strong, then we have to focus on climate change, and we have to take the measures and the precautions to deal with that.
Hey, it's going to affect you someday, so just be cautious and don't allow yourself to be part of the problem.
But as students across at least 98 countries plan to join the strike, on Tuesday, President Trump tweeted another message questioning the science behind climate change.
Hi, I'm Kayra. I'm 12 years old.
Hi, my name is Sophia. I go to the School Lady of Pompeii, and I'm 12 years old.
Well, the president does really just focus on building the wall, which is honestly not that important because, honestly, we're all people.
I would think that he should take a little bit of focus off of his wall and onto climate change. But, yeah, that's just me.
Instead of building a wall, we should focus on climate change.
I would tell the authority figure that they should really take action and take control over the problems.
Young Americans say they hope that Friday's protests will be a very visible reminder that climate change demands action.
Haven Coleman, I am 12 years old, almost 13. I will be 13 on March 29th.
Haven is one of the founders and co-directors of the U.S. Youth Climate Strike.
I'm really looking for, like, since we have so many locations, like almost all 50 states, I think we're only missing like 3 states, that it'll like be a big turnout so that we can like catch the adults' attention and get adults to actually stop and think and actually act. Climate change is not only just going to affect me and my future, it's going to be affecting everybody and everyone and every generation after mine.
And she told us why this issue is so important to her.
We've dealt with it. We've grown up with climate change. I always remember hearing about this hurricane, this flood, this drought. Like Colorado, where I live, has been in a 19-year drought. We've grown up on climate change. And so when we hear that we have a chance to stop the worst effects, to stop anything, to do anything, we've taking that opportunity, which is sort of surprising that the adults haven't been taking this opportunity.
The youth-led demonstration will highlight some of the generational tensions that define the threat of climate change. Joining me now is Eric Holthaus, a meteorologist and staff writer at GRIST. Eric, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
So we know that young people have been involved in climate change efforts in the past, but this strikes me as a new wave. I mean, we've talked about this on The Takeaway, that it even crosses political lines. Is that what you're seeing, and what's driving it?
Yeah, I mean, I trace this back for several years, as you say. You know, this has been going on, young people really at the forefront of this new wave of climate action, going back to the Giuliana court case, which was a group of 21 kids that filed a lawsuit against the Obama administration for not doing enough to stop climate change. This was about 3 years ago. That court case hasn't really gone anywhere, and they've since, you know, shifted their target to the Trump administration. But then there was a youth-led march last summer in D.C. called Zero Hour that was led by a woman, Jamie Margolin, 16-year-old girl. And then it just sort of took off. This past summer, a teenager in Sweden, Greta Thunberg, decided that the marches weren't enough, so she was going to go on strike every Friday in front of the center of government in her town. And that just has snowballed since then.
You mentioned Greta Thunberg. She's obviously been getting a lot of attention. She's even met with world leaders. What does that tell us about the movement? I mean, when world leaders start getting involved here, it looks good on the outside, but is there any concern that this is just the optics, or this is actually going to lead to some change?
No, this is a really great point that you make. At some point, there needs to be a fine line between making people in power feel uncomfortable and having them listen. So I think this school strike movement so far is towing that line pretty well. you know, she's been very insistent. Whatever's happening right now, the status quo, what governments are doing is just not enough. You know, she is saying consistently, and youth around the world are saying, that on the current path, they're going to be growing up without a future. The Secretary General of Amnesty International yesterday released a statement ahead of the strike saying that this is one of the greatest intergenerational human rights violations in history. So the school strike movement, I think, is getting the backing of all of the centers of power in social movements broadly, not just in climate change. I think that's where the difference lies here, is that they're finally making the connection to civil rights and human rights, and not just something nice to do for the environment.
And do you think that'll actually move the needle in terms of policy? Because a few weeks ago, young members of the Sunrise Movement confronted Senator Dianne Feinstein about the Green New Deal. So is the pressure going to be enough to move the needle?
I mean, it has to be at some point. You know, there is a really tough pill that scientists have given humanity, that we only have, you know, roughly a decade or so to make drastic changes in our society, not going beyond cutting fossil fuel emissions, but the social infrastructure that would have to be in place in order to really make those emissions changes feel inevitable is very different than what we have today. This is a new social compact for humanity, really, is what the youth are asking for. And that's the kind of political environment, I think, that would make climate change feel like an, of course, we need to fix this immediately. And so, you know, maybe at this exact moment, it feels like what they're asking for is too much, but what they're asking for is in line with what the science says is necessary. And so, therefore, I guess, I mean, my way of thinking about this is, by definition, what they're asking for is appropriate because it's what's necessary.
Eric Holthaus is a meteorologist and staff writer at Grist. Eric, thanks again.
Yeah, thanks so much.
This week marks 8 years since the start of the Syrian civil war. Hundreds of thousands of people have been killed in the conflict, and according to the United Nations, half of all Syrians have fled their homes. One of those who left was Marwan Hisham. He's the co-author of Brothers of the Gun, a memoir of the Syrian war. Today he joins us from Ankara, Turkey, where he's lived since 2016. Marwan, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you for having me, Tanzina.
When protests first broke out, how old were you? And tell us about that experience.
I was 21, just about the time when I was about to graduate from college. I was in Aleppo, but when the protests started in Raqqa, I was in my hometown at the time. So I started to go with friends whenever we heard about protests and, yeah, participate in them.
You write about two of your childhood friends who joined the opposition. Tell us about them. How did the war affect them?
We grew up in a relatively poor neighborhood, same background, and we were, the whole composition of the society was patriarchal. So we had religion, traditions, fathers, and the state all competing to, you know, to make us think the way they want. And then when the Arab Spring happened all across the Arab world, we thought we had an opening when we can express ourselves and kind of liberate ourselves and feel this self-confidence that we can actually be part of this change. In a sense, it was even generational. Yeah, we thought we can keep up with the world. We can change. We can change the whole system of you know, religious versus religious and ideologies adopted by the regime to shape our future in a way that we thought so outdated. As soon as we started to protest, we kind of broke up. We kind of broke this this fear in us, and we felt this sense of communality with other people, with people especially like us, because the generation older than us, very few of them had access to education that we did. Me and my friends will have lots of discussions about, you know, how the protest should go, what's our goal, and how what's our visions for the future of our country, until the nature of the movement, the protest movement, changed into something more violent. So here we started to see it differently. My friends decided to join this armed rebellion because they thought that this is the only way you can get rid of the regime. And here where I thought differently, that a civil war is simply not the answer.
What was it like living under ISIS control?
Well, under ISIS, you're being watched all the time, and you're not safe. They could arrest you for anything, for so many things that you would think they're, you know, normal. Basically, for them, they're not okay. The way how you dress, the way how you speak, the way how you behave generally in public. And any sort of accusation could be, for them, it could be interpreted in a way so extreme and end up with even execution. And anyone who wasn't part of this system had to be suspected and had to be basically neutralized in a way. So it was daily nightmare where no one felt safe.
Despite all of that that you just described, you continue to take photographs and send them to Molly Crabapple, who you collaborated with on the memoir that you wrote. How were you able to do that, given that level of control by ISIS?
I had two helping factors. The first is that I studied Sharia when I was in the secondary school. I went to a religious school, so I can basically defend my behavior. This is one thing. I knew their mood. I knew where they come from. And the second thing is that I had daily interaction with them because I worked in a cafe where I would see them every day and I would speak to them. So I knew where's the red line and the margin for maneuvers. But still, it was too risky for anyone to take pictures because I'd be simply labeled as a spy. So basically, just try to be cautious, not to be caught, and do something that very few could do.
The Syrian President Bashar al-Assad is still in power. Is that an indicator that he's won the war?
Well, it depends on what we mean by winning the war. If we mean that he's gonna stay and able to, the whole regime able to survive, then he definitely won. But if we mean that he's able to restore full control of the country and to restore the legitimacy among the international community, then he is definitely far away from that. Right now, he controls two-thirds of the country, and he's an isolated president. In the last 8 years, he only visited two countries, Iran and Russia. And when the Sudanese president visited him in Damascus, there was much international condemnation about this, and he's still in this way far away from being victorious.
Do you expect, Marwan, that you'll ever return to Syria?
Yes, and I am actually planning to, because my city now is under the control of the SDF, or the Syrian Democratic Forces. the group that is now backed by the international coalition led by the United States. And my city is very devastated, but it's people there trying to rebuild their lives. And I feel like I need to be part of that. I need to help the, you know, the city and my people to, in whatever little I can offer and be part of this rebuilding process.
I've been speaking with Marwan Hisham, the author or the co-author of Brothers of the Gun, about his life in Syria during the war. Thanks so much, Marwan.
Thank you.
And that's our show for today. And we want to thank WKSU and Kent State University for having us this week. Thank you so much to Ellie Ellis, Andrew Meyer, Dan Kuznicki, and everyone else on the staff here. Your warm welcome and bagels were so appreciated. And I also want to send a heartfelt thanks to the Kent State School of Journalism and Mass Communication, who honored me with the Robert G. Magruder Distinguished Guest Lecturer Award for Diversity in Media this week. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.